Charlie Chaplin has been making audiences laugh for over 100 years now. Yet Chaplin fell into a curious obscurity after World War II. Dan Kamen is on a mission to remind audiences of Chaplin's genius in a one-of-a-kind program at Spivey Hall tomorrow afternoon. I spoke with Dan about teaching Robert Downey Jr. how to move like Charlie Chaplin, as well as Dan's performance at Spivey Hall. We're going to hear, as Dan explains, how Chaplin fell out of favor in 1950s Hollywood.
Well, Chaplin ran afoul. He made a film in 1940 about Hitler, lampooning Hitler. It was called The Great Dictator. He called him Adnoid Hinkle, the dictator of Tomania. The official government line was, don't do anything to aggravate the Europeans. It's their problem. And here he made this film lampooning Hitler as a buffoon, and it was a year before Pearl Harbor was attacked. And so Chaplin did something that he felt was his responsibility as an artist who'd gained an international following.
But by the 50s and 60s, certainly that idea should have changed. I mean, government opposition, we know the outcome of what happened after 1940.
People who were against Hitler before the official line was to be against Hitler, also the temerity of a mere entertainer having the presumption to try to influence public opinion about something as critical as should we get involved in an international incident in a war. Those people were considered left-wing radicals. And in fact, Chaplin was always considered, he was left-wing. At that time, there were very few actors who publicly did that. Chaplin was a Brit who never became an American citizen, and suddenly that became a public issue. Is he a traitor? Is he a communist? Especially as the Red Scare, the Cold War, heated up. And so the government began waging a campaign. You see, they couldn't fire him. They couldn't blacklist him. It was the time of the blacklist. And they couldn't blacklist him because he owned the studio. He was one of the four artists who created United Artists in 1919. So he was in a position of being able to finance and distribute his own films. What they could do is turn public opinion against him. And they did that in a very, very coordinated campaign in the late 40s and early 50s that ultimately drove him out of the country.
You're actually part of the movie Chaplin, made in 1992 with Robert Downey Jr. in the title role. What was your contribution to that film?
Well, I wrote a book about Charlie Chaplin because I wanted to somehow know more about it. I read every book I could find, but I didn't find the book that I wanted to read, which was the book that explained why jokes that are made, now it's over 100 years ago, his first films were made in 1914, why jokes made that long ago are still funny. And ultimately, I realized the only way I could read the book that I wanted to read was to write it. And who was going to read that? But one of the people was Robert Downey, who looked at it and said, oh, instantly, well, this is like a training manual for my film. And he got me hired by the production to coach him to be Chaplin. But it became more than that, because when I was sent the script, I realized that it wasn't viable. You know, making a movie about Charlie Chaplin is sort of like composing a symphony about Beethoven. You know, it's you know, he made the best movies about Charlie Chaplin that could be made. And when I met the director, Richard Attenborough, I explained that I wouldn't be able to help Robert be funny in scenes that were not written funny. And without missing a beat, he said, of course, my boy, and this is what you will do for us. And so I ended up creating a number of the film's comedy scenes that were not recreations. And Robert and I began a daily regimen. He flew to Pittsburgh 2 weeks after, and we began the formidable task because, again, playing the role of Charlie Chaplin would be as if they said, Lois, we're going to do a film about Beverly Sills, and we'd like you to play Beverly. And by the way, no dubbing, because you have to do the voice, because Chaplin's art was the way he moved. And the first thing Robert said to me when he walked in was, I want you to tell me how to hold my fork.
Oh, I thought he was marvelous in the role. So tell us what we can expect at Spivey.
Spivey Hall has brought in Stephen Ball, who is a world-renowned accompanist of silent films, and he's going to accompany the pawn shop in the way that it was accompanied in 1916 when it came out with live music. And there's a legend that it was a pianist, a solo pianist, looking up, squinting up at the screen. Only the smallest theater would have had just a pianist. Any theater of any size would have had a theater organ, which had all kinds of sound effects as well, or a full symphony orchestra of 50 people, pit. They were so popular that the live music experience was part of the movie experience then, and it gives movies a gives the silent movies, when you hear them with live music, this strange, almost uncanny sense of reality, because there's a living person participating in them.
Mm. Well, Dan Kimmon, I want to thank you for joining us appropriately on City Lights, and especially for taking us into the artist's process, both Chaplin's and your own. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure talking with you, Lois.